in the heyday of an environmental movement and an emerging anti-environmental backlash that were often in the news, but too frequently lacked historical perspective, I found Aldo Leopold's story to be powerfully grounded and grounding. It provided connections across generations and perspectives and landscapes. It exposed forgotten foundations and offered continuity amid complexity. Now I find that grounding and continuity more important than ever. As I write, crude oil gushes out from the depths of the Gulf of Mexico, bringing devastation to the Gulf's waters and wildlife, the coastal wetlands, and the region's human communities and economies. In the oil's sheen, we see mingled reflections of all our daunting contemporary issues and anxieties: global climate change and degraded oceans, fossil fuel dependence and economic upheaval, biodiversity loss and food security, corporate irresponsibility and political corruption. It would be comforting if we could now read Leopold's story and find it dated and nostalgic. We cannot. We have not yet achieved what Leopold once called the oldest task in human history, to live on a piece of land without spoiling it.
What prompted cultural critic Wendell Berry to say, of all the conservationists who have preceded us, Leopold was the most radical, the most complex, and therefore the most needed? What aspects of his personality and writing brought Leopold into prominence and keep him there? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What were the conditions that turned Leopold into a radical environmentalist? How effective was he in changing land use? And what did Leopold mean when he referred to thinking like a mountain? Our guest is Kurt Meine, the Director for Conservation Biology and History with the Center for Humans and Nature, Senior Fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation, Research Associate with the International Crane Foundation, the author of Aldo Leopold, His Life and Work, to be published by the UW Press in 2010, and the narrator of the upcoming film documentary, Green Fire.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I saw Aldo Leopold's birth date of 1887, and it came as sort of a shock just because he seems such a modern figure. And as you said in that introduction, if you hear the oil spill, you think of Leopold and what he said so eloquently. Tell us about your sense of Leopold and his place in history.
Emily, you put your finger right on it. The aspect of Leopold that makes him unique in our history is how he connects us across those generations. There's no other figure in our conservation history who connects what's going on now and into the future with the deep origins of conservation and environmental thought. He is a son of the 1800s and of the early progressive era conservation movement, but he's also the key link between that early movement and the more modern environmental movement. And now we're moving into a new phase. We don't know what this next, maybe post-environmentalism phase is going to be or what it's becoming, but Leopold is still right there in the middle. And he's such an intriguing figure because he connects generations. He allows young people who are struggling with the same issues that we've struggled with in our lifetimes. I'm not so young anymore. But he allows us a common figure to think about and to work around. And there's no other figure. We have many great conservation people in our legacy here in Wisconsin and nationally, the Gaylord Nelsons and Theodore Roosevelts, John Muir, and so on. But Leopold has a special way of connecting us across generations through his writing, but also through the relevance of his ideas.
It surprises me when I look and see, well, he's not from Wisconsin, he's not from New Mexico, he's actually born in Burlington, Iowa, and then spent time in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. He spent his early years along the Mississippi River in Burlington, Iowa, which was a major port on the river and as well as an important railroad crossing. It's where the Burlington Northern got its name. And so, as I like to say, these were the two great axes of American development, the river and the railroad. And Leopold literally had a bird's eye view from his house atop the hill above Burlington.
And what's known of his childhood? Was he always a lover of nature?
He seems to have been from day one, and it was sort of bred into him through his family. Both his mother and father, in very different ways, had a very important impact on this precocious young naturalist. His father was an enthusiastic hunter, and conservationist before there was a conservation movement. But his father, he also ran a furniture factory, a successful company, the Leopold Desk Company. And so his father was acutely aware also of what was happening with the forests of the upper Midwest, the wood supply of that period in the late 1800s. His mother had this very strong aesthetic sensibility about her. She loved the opera. She loved writing. She loved stories. And so I think it was through her prompting that Aldo Leopold began his lifelong literary career, mostly with letters home, when he went away to school in New Jersey to a prep school called Lawrenceville Preparatory School.
It's interesting that at that time, and for many years afterward, in Iowa, for example, there was a bounty on wolves. So it's not as if all animals were considered, you know, wonderful, and that wild nature was always considered something to be revered in the setting in which Leopold was born.
Yeah, again, his story conveys so much of the larger story of our relationship between American people and the American landscape. And so you have to put yourself back in the late 1800s when our north woods of Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan were being stripped, when the waterfowl and other wildlife was being decimated, when the rivers were being changed, when the wetlands were being drained, when the prairies were being plowed up. The entire Midwestern landscape was being transformed. And there was no conservation movement to speak of until Leopold's youth, until he is actually in his teenage years when Teddy Roosevelt becomes president and when Gifford Pinchot, the first major figure in American forestry, becomes a national figure and starts what would become the U.S. Forest Service. So Leopold comes of age with the conservation movement, absorbs it, and all his life he's tracking the development of conservation through his own life and work.
And did he have encounters with Native American thinking on the land?
That is a great question, and it's one of the questions that those of us who study Leopold have not done enough on, although just recently we've begun to see some more interest in that. As a matter of fact, just recently I discovered a little scholarly footnote that I knew about but that I did a little deeper digging into. When he was away at prep school, one of the first speakers he heard give a lecture was a fellow named Charles Eastman, a very important figure in the history of Native American thought. And he heard this lecture. He didn't know who this prominent figure was, but he was touched by what Mr. Eastman said. And he quoted in a letter home to his mother, he said, "I've heard this speaker. He's a true Indian. He has the sensibility. He describes nature as the gate to the great mystery." So Leopold early on had this sense of the Native American worldview. Then he goes to work in the American Southwest, where he encounters Native American cultures very directly, as well as Hispanic American culture that he eventually marries into, actually. So he begins to understand the cultural complexity around conservation ideas very early on. And it may be, and I think this myself, one of the most important things that shaped him and made him such a unique figure in the development of our conservation ideas, the sensitivity to the cultural context of the work of conservation.
And it seems as if he has the feeling that we shouldn't have dominion over the land. You know, this sort of, there is in Leopold, is there not a sense that the land should be respected in and of itself?
That's at the core of Leopold's worldview in his mature philosophy. But it took him a long time to get there, and it took him a long time to develop that idea. The early years of the Forest Service, they were of the progressive era when the experts trained at Yale with all the technical abilities were sent out there to manage the forests, which according to the early philosophy of the Forest Service was, in fact, to manage it very directly and strongly, that is, to take control over the forest. Leopold's story is one of gradual evolution, highlighted by a few important episodes along the way where he begins to understand we can't control nature. We have to learn to live and work with it for the benefit of the natural world as well as for our own human culture and communities.
Was he affected by other, I'll call them nature writers in the broad sense, in those formative years? You know, John Muir's work certainly was out there, and even somebody like Jack London, who wrote very much about, you know, the outdoors and the struggles there. Did Leopold pick up any of his literary abilities that way and his ethic having to do with land use?
I certainly did. He was a very, very enthusiastic reader and a wide reader, especially after he goes away to school. And he keeps pretty careful records of what he's reading, too. So we know a lot about what he was absorbing. You did mention John Muir. He certainly knew John Muir's work very well.
What about Thoreau?
He knew Thoreau. In fact, his parents, as a wedding present to him and Estella, gave him a complete set of Thoreau's journals. Ernest Thompson Seton.
Oh, yes, a very important one. Wild Animals I Have Known.
A very important one for young Leopold. As for so many of that generation, Leopold was not alone. These were important. Jack London, another one. Very important figures. John Burroughs. That whole generation of great naturalist writers, Leopold absorbed them pretty well through his youth.
How successful was he at Yale?
That's a good question. I often show two pictures when I give lectures on Leopold. One of this earnest, young, Midwestern young man going off to study in the East, and he's serious and staring into the camera. And the next one shows this kind of jovial man about town. With a big smile on his face, and I always say, this is what the East Coast does to nice Midwestern boys.
Which is the before and which is the after.
So he became much more of a social animal at Yale, but in his studies he was always, with a few episodes like most of us have in our educational careers, he was very, very studious and successful in school. He always had just not just a native intelligence, but a sensitivity to knowledge. And I think there's a difference there. He understood the connections between fields of knowledge. And that becomes his lifelong pattern of always trying to connect ideas, places, people, natural history and science, and the larger political, social context. He's always a connector. And even in those early Yale days, he was doing that.
What were his ambitions as a student? I mean, what did he expect to do once he got out?
Well, he was very typical of this young generation of budding conservationists. If you were a young conservationist in the early 1900s, you really had only a few choices. And the best choice you had, if you were smart enough to do it, was to go to Yale and get trained in forestry. Yale had the Yale Forest School, as it was then called, is the oldest continually existing forest school in the country. And it just started up in about 1905, I think, was its first graduating class, endowed by the Pinchot family, the family of Gifford Pinchot, the chief forester of Teddy Roosevelt. And Aldo was in the fourth graduating class. And the ambition of almost all of these young, and they were all young men at that point, there are no women yet in the conservation, professional conservation world, but their ambition was always to go into the young Forest Service and get assigned to wherever they were going to be assigned to.
What kind of experience did he have then when he was sent to New Mexico and started working as a Forest Service person?
He arrives as a total greenhorn. He'd never stepped... Well, that's not true. He took one trip west when he was a young boy, out to Yellowstone, actually, with his father. But he had never been to the Southwest. And he arrives, and it's not even... It's Arizona Territory. It's not even a state
yet. Oh, sure, pre-1912.
Mm-hmm. And he gets off the train and goes to work on what was the brand new Apache National Forest. And the first couple years of his career are really an abject lesson in the greenhorn getting educated to the ways of the West, making mistakes, glorying in the beauty and wonder of this amazing landscape, learning the native cultures, sometimes not learning the native cultural context, but eventually finding his home there and finding his bearings, literally finding his bearings, because that's the job of a forester, to be out on the landscape in those days, taking stock of what's on the land. And that was really what his first few jobs, official tasks were.
How would his approach, as taught at Yale through that school, mm-hmm. how would his approach then to forest management differ from now?
Well, I suppose the most important dimension of that is when Leopold begins his career, and that generation begins their work as professional conservationists, the science of ecology is embryonic. It's not part of their curriculum. It's not part of their worldview. It's not part of the way they understand the relationship between people and the natural world. And one way to understand Leopold's whole career is the infusion of this new science and the new worldview it brings to us into Leopold's work. And so when he begins, he's really in the mode and mold of his mentor, Gifford Pinchot, which has a strong utilitarian mode to it. It's really all about how can we manage these forests for human good over the long run. And that becomes the mold, again, of all these young foresters. And to most of them, that meant, how do we sustain the yield of timber off of these forests? Or in the case of the Southwest, they were also interested in water because it's arid country. And it would take many years before Leopold would see and convince his fellow foresters to see the forest is more than just a source of raw material. But that's how he starts out.
You mentioned that he got married to someone from the Hispanic American culture. He got married in Santa Fe, right?
He did.
Tell us about his wife, his family, and what difference that made to his life, his development.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful story of the courtship of Aldo and Estella Leopold. Estella, his to-be wife, was the daughter of a very prominent ranching family. In fact, they were said to be the largest sheep-owning family of the entire West at one point. And their family's history goes back into old Mexico, all the way back to old Spain. And so Aldo Leopold, this German sort of Lutheran fellow from the Midwest, ends up marrying into this Catholic Hispanic family of deep roots in the Southwest. The great funny story of that is both families were sort of checking on each other as they were courting, when they were kind of going behind each other's backs to make sure this was going to be a good match. Because you can imagine it was,
Culture shock. Not
totally uncommon, it was pretty rare still for people to marry across that cultural boundary. But once they checked each other out and met each other, they really became quite close, both families. But it wasn't just marrying into an Hispanic family, you're marrying into a ranching family. And as Leopold is a professional, part of his job is to be the federal agent working with and sometimes having to work against the native ranching community of the Southwest. So he's in a fairly precarious position.
So what would have been the things that would have been bones of contention between ranchers and somebody with his training?
Right. Well, put yourself back, it's the 19-teens, and the Southwest in particular is coming out of about a 40-year period of heavy, heavy grazing to the point where primarily cattle grazing, especially as Texan ranchers moved into Arizona and New Mexico, they went through a wave that was really quite devastating to the conditions of the range landscape. And so one of the reasons the Forest Service was put into place in this region was to bring some rational control to this destructive force. And many of the ranchers welcomed this. They knew that things were not healthy out there on the landscape.
Sheep did tend to, they had a reputation for being really hard on the land, didn't they?
Sheep, yeah, they absolutely did. But it was also the cattle coming in from Texas. And it was this mix, actually, that was new and different. And that there was no, again, science or practice of range management or conservation to help guide it. Leopold becomes a pioneer in that field. But becomes very personal because usually, especially, let's say, a typical spring day, you're going to be working with these ranchers to issue permits. They never had to have permits before. Now they have to have permits from the federal government to go graze their livestock on these federal national forests. And so that was a typical task for many, but keeping an eye on the ranching and working with the ranchers to try to improve the conditions out on the land.
As Leopold was working there in the West, did he start seeing the need for preserving more land, having more parks?
Actually, interesting the way you phrase it. It wasn't parks he was looking at. The National Park Movement was afoot. And as he was going into his early career years, the Park Service actually was created in 1916. He actually said, well, we don't need more parks here. But what he did notice that when he arrived in the Southwest, there were no cars on the landscape yet. The automobile comes into the landscape as Leopold goes to work. He starts his career on horseback. And all the early pictures of Leopold in the Forest Service are him on with horses. Within 10 years, though, the automobile was coming into the landscape. And that meant more roads. And more roads meant the breaking apart, the fragmenting of these large expanses of wild country. And this became one of his overriding passions. How can we act before we lose what we've always taken for granted, the presence of large open expanses of wild or semi-wild land? The national parks couldn't do that. In fact, the national parks were part of it because they were bringing the railroads and tourism these landscapes.
Right.
He actually worked on the Grand Canyon before it was a national park, and he warned that if we did not act now to not just protect it, but also to protect it from the tourism that it's drawing, that we would lose these values that he felt so strongly about.
There was precedent, of course, with the railroads that, you know, had divided the great buffalo herds some 50 years before that.
Indeed. And, of course, the railroads were the interstate highways of their time and had both these benefits and drawbacks to those thinking about conservation.
So, I mean, was it the same conundrum that national parks have today for Leopold back 1918, 1920. How do you preserve this and yet make it accessible to as many people as possible?
He understood that dilemma, which was built into the DNA of the Park Service. But he also looked beyond that. He kept pushing further beyond that. He had a phrase later in his life. He said, recreational development is not a job of building roads into lovely country. It's a job of building receptivity into the still unlovely human mind. And so his focus was always, it's not just a matter of having people out there in the landscape, it's having a chance for people to see into the dynamism and life of a landscape, to understand how the land works. And sometimes parks could be almost a substitute for that. And he feared that. He wanted to increase the ecological literacy and understanding of people. So wherever they were, whether it was in a national park or in an urban city block, they could understand how it worked and how we were part of it and how we could be either a healthy, helpful part or we could also be a destructive part. Parks were useful because they helped sensitize people to landscapes. But he also feared that it could also desensitize us in this ironic way.
We're going to follow Aldo Leopold to Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Kurt Meine, who's telling us about the life and the work of Aldo Leopold, the great environmentalist, et cetera, who at this point in his life, this is 1918, 1920 or so, he has been assigned to New Mexico by the Forest Service, his employer, has married into an Hispanic family, a very long standing in New Mexico, and now still is at the whim of the Forest Service, right, in terms of where he goes and sort of what land he invests himself into?
Yeah, he has a few more years in the Southwest. One of his passions is wilderness, as we already have discussed. Another of them is wildlife and wildlife management. It still is kind of in an embryonic form. And his third big passion down there was the health of watersheds, how our land use affected water and the way water works in the landscape. And these all kind of wove through his time in the Southwest. By this time, he's the number two guy in the Southwestern hierarchy of the Forest Service. It gives him a chance to travel all over the landscape and see these forces at work, both in the human communities and in the landscape. But then he sort of surprises maybe even himself, and certainly future scholars of Leopold, when he decides to uproot his family and move back to the Midwest. He comes back to Madison, Wisconsin, where he becomes assistant director of the Forest Products Lab, the main wood research facility of the U.S. Forest Service, which is still here in Madison. And he took this job being told that the director was going to retire in a few months and he would be kicked up. But that fellow, his boss stayed on for another 18 years, I think.
Oh,
so Aldo Leopold was working a desk job, which was not his kind of, not his cup of tea, really.
How did he get out of that hole?
Well, he spent 4 years and did great work. He enjoyed the work at the Forest Products Lab. It was intellectually challenging to him, but his passion really was wildlife. This was where he was always moving. So finally, after 4 years, he left amicably the Forest Service to devote himself full-time to laying the foundations of what we now know as wildlife ecology and management.
Who was hiring him to do that work?
Initially, he was hired actually by the private sector. The manufacturers of ammunition and guns actually hired him because there was a real fear at that point that as Americans were becoming more urban and mechanized, that they were losing hunting traditions. But you were also losing wildlife out there on the landscape as farming became more intensive and mechanized. There was this great fear that we would be losing even populations of small game animals like rabbits and other things that we take for granted right now. So Leopold steps into this breach saying we need a new field in conservation focused on protecting, restoring, and sustaining populations of game, and then later, a few years later, they would use a more inclusive term, wildlife.
So was he doing field work then, sort of getting data about where animals were and so on?
The focus of his activities for 3 years, and going into the Depression years, was to go around the upper Midwest, the eight states of the upper Midwest, and to examine what the conditions of wildlife habitat and wildlife populations were on the ground. to talk to all the leading experts that he could reach, to talk to scientists and policymakers and landowners and farmers, and try to gauge what was going on out there. This was unprecedented. No one had ever done anything like this, especially with a scientific attitude. And so this is what Leopold devoted himself for about 3 years, 3 or 4 years, producing what is now a pretty obscure report called the Game Survey of the North Central States. But this is really the foundation stone of modern wildlife conservation.
What was the status of game, especially in Wisconsin mm-hmm. in the 1920s? I mean, was the deer population anything like it would be 80 years later?
Well, anyone in Wisconsin who spoke to their great grandfather or grandfather knows that it was very different back then. White-tailed deer were scarce in Wisconsin. With the denuded north woods and the southern prairies turned over to farming, we pretty much lost our white-tailed deer population. It's hard to even imagine that now. The deer population was just beginning to recover in the north country, but it was still pretty much absent from the south. So there was a real fear that we would lose even what is now obviously a common critter, the white-tailed deer, but we were also losing, the waterfowl populations were plummeting, wetlands were being drained. More specialized in my area, cranes, you can take cranes as a good index to the sandhill cranes, which are now again a recovered species, were near extinction in Wisconsin in the late 20s and early 30s, and the whooping crane was just assumed that it was not going to make it.
Not too many wolves either, I gather.
Wolves were declining rapidly and would be lost from the state in the 1950s. They would hang on there in the North Country, but they, of course, had been long since extirpated from the South.
Now, Leopold became part of the University of Wisconsin then, right?
Yeah, after finishing the game survey, he's pretty much sharing the fate of the country. He's unemployed for a while. He hangs out a shingle as a self-employed consultant, but...
nice work if you can get it.
Yeah, and there wasn't much to be got. But through a confluence of events, he becomes an appointed professor of game management at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison in 1933. And this is probably the first such position in the country. And there are a couple other somewhat equivalent positions being created, but Leopold was really the first formal professor of wildlife management, as it would later be called, in 1933 here in Madison.
And where does he go with that?
Well, he's a one-man department for the first 4 or 5 years, in fact, until quite late in his life. But he begins by taking on a few of bright young students who would become the leaders for the next generation. He's sort of recapitulating, if you think about it, his own career. He was a young forester under Gifford Pinchot and the professors at Yale, and he's doing the same thing here. In fact, he's taking many of the same principles of sustained yield forestry and applying them to wildlife populations. So this first generation trains under Leopold and a few others out there now, and they go to work doing research. Leopold was also the extension agent for Wisconsin and wildlife, so he's doing things like the University of the Air. Mm-hmm. He was on the air on this very program back in the 1930s and 40s on a pretty regular basis. He begins writing for the general population. He's very much an exemplar of the Wisconsin idea, very much a voice of the university reaching out and talking with farmers, landowners, sportsmen, citizens about their concerns for conservation.
So kind of an extension of the old extension idea.
Absolutely.
Not just agriculture, but all these other industries and mm-hmm.
And what was his personality like? I mean, was he funny? Was he humble? Was he abrasive? You know, what was he like?
Well, I can say that when I was younger and working on my biography of Leopold, I interviewed as many of the people who knew Leopold firsthand as were still alive. Fortunately, there were a number of them. And there was never any indication of anything but a positive person here. He had no enemies. He had people he disagreed with, and some he had to disagree with very strongly, but they were not people who knew him personally. Most people who knew Leopold described him as wonderfully pleasant, very dry sense of humor, kind of very understated, very reticent man, but also very, very tolerant of his students and where they were in their own intellectual development, and a wonderful mentor. He comes across, at least to the biographer, as someone who is very self-reflective, but he's not self-absorbed. He's alive and out there in the world, looking at the natural world, engaged in policy, engaged in the great flux of society, and trying to make a difference for what he saw as the good. So there are very few negative comments that you come across about Leopold? It's pretty rare, I guess, for a figure as prominent as him to have such a positive record.
You mentioned his transition from game management to wildlife management, and there's this pivotal moment that he relates in a Sand County Almanac. He's talking about having shot a wolf, and he says, "We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then, and I have known ever since, that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain. I was young then and full of trigger itch. I thought that because fewer wolves meant more deer, that no wolves would mean hunter's paradise. But after seeing the green fire die, I sensed that neither the wolf nor the mountain agreed with such a view." Did that really happen? Or was it a literary device?
Ah, therein lies a tale. When I wrote the biography of Leopold Beck, almost more than 20 years ago now, I could not find firm documentary evidence. Apart from that essay that you just read for, Leopold didn't refer to it. And he was a letter writer and a journal keeper, and there was no reference to it. So I did my best through a matter of triangulation and checking the evidence that I could. I identified a period when I thought it would most logically have happened, assuming that Leopold was not one to make things up whole cloth. And I let it go at that, and I put a big long footnote in the book to make sure I was scholarly correct. And I left it at that, and over the years, many people have said, well, you know, Leopold, that's okay. He was a writer, and occasionally you could bend the truth or even make something up if you felt it served your literary purpose. And I always had a feeling that, no, he wouldn't do that. It was not his style. So we had a friendly argument in our little community of Leopold scholars about this, and then lo and behold, it was a little over a year ago, a new letter came to light, which identified actually the incident and where and when it happened. And again, through cross-checking a bunch of different evidence, maps and letters and survey records and so forth, we were actually able to locate the time and place when this did happen. Now, as a scholar, this is both a wonderful thing and a little fearful thing, because I then said, uh-oh, I hope I got it right. So I went back to my original footnote and book passage on Leopold, and lo and behold, if it didn't fit in exactly where I had thought it would happen. That's pretty rare where you get that kind of satisfaction.
It's such a beautiful passage. Norman mentioned the Sand County Almanac, which, of course, Leopold is so well known for. What led Leopold to get the shack? And was he sort of following Thoreau's path of having a sort of Walden Pond retreat?
Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't like Thoreau. Leopold purchased the shack property in central Wisconsin in 1935. Land is cheap. This is land that had been abused and overfarmed, and it was a wreck. And Leopold was able to pick it up for $8 an acre.
Wow.
And like much of Wisconsin, it was in a state of degradation. And his first interest was actually, I wanted a place to go hunting. He was an enthusiastic early archer. Archery was a family passion, and they wanted a place where they could practice their archery and maybe go hunting. And there were deer in this area, actually, and so it was one of the few places where you could hunt deer in Wisconsin with bow and arrow. But very quickly, within just months after, he began to see a different potential for this place. And he and his family begin this epic story of trying to restore this little piece of degraded, worn-out Wisconsin. Every spring break from the university here, as well as any other weekend they could get free, they were up there planting prairies and planting pine trees to stabilize the soil, bringing in the native wildflowers of the region, and also having a darn good time while they were doing it. And so it's a story of the restoration of the land, but it's also a story of a family's commitment to this place that would play out over the generations now. But it actually starts out very simply. He was not one to go off to the shack to write great, thoughtful essays.
Not
he
did a rusticator.
His writing, he did his writing here in Madison very early in the morning. He was something of an insomniac. He would get up extremely early in the morning and walk down to his office here on the west end of the university campus. And that's probably where, I don't know, 90% of Sand County Almanac was composed.
What kind of resistance did he meet to his ideas by the time we get into the 1930s, and he's really achieving prominence and becoming a major voice in Wisconsin?
Yeah. You asked earlier whether what kind of person Leopold was, and I said that he didn't have a lot of outright enemies, but he did have a lot of controversies in his life, and in the 30s they begin to pick up again. He's fighting for wilderness on a national level starting in the mid-1930s. The Wilderness Society is founded in 1935, the first national conservation group devoted to protecting wilderness. And he's a charter member and sort of their philosophical elder statesman. And this doesn't sit well with forces of development, including his own colleagues in the Forest Service in some cases. Then he gets involved in the controversy in Wisconsin that would affect him for the rest of his life. The deer herd that had been decimated was now starting to rebound by the mid-30s as the northern forests recovered. The deer populations were also beginning to recover to the point where they are lacking predators, beginning to overbrowse the forest. Leopold had seen what a high deer population could do. He'd seen it in the Southwest. He knew about it happening in other parts of the country from colleagues. And he was absolutely dedicated to not letting that happen in Wisconsin. He said, we can have our deer, and we can have our forest too. He took a trip to Germany in 1935, his only overseas trip, and he saw there what could happen if you did not have an approach to conservation that balanced all the parts of the system. He saw these intensively managed forests and these intensively managed deer herds and saw that they were actually working against each other. The deer were eating up the forest. There was nothing in the forest left for the deer to eat. So he worked very hard to keep that from happening in Wisconsin. And that meant having to fight very hard against a lot of different interests, against the resort owners, against even his fellow deer hunters, against the deer protectors, the sort of anti-hunting element of the time. So it's a very difficult position to be in, and he had to play that role for the rest of his life.
And so what did he prescribe? More hunting or bring in wolves? It seems kind of early for that sort of thinking.
Well, as always, Leopold, first thing he would advocate is research. You can't make good decisions if you don't have good science to help you. So immediately he tried to get his students and his fellow professional people in the conservation arena to pay attention, to put some money and time into understanding what's going on out there. He did advocate for taking the bounty off of wolves. Let the wolves come back because they're kind of a fine tool. He used to think of them as a sort of a fine management tool. We could keep deer populations down, but it's the wolves that kept them moving around the landscape, kept deer populations healthy. He advocated for hunting does. And in a
still
culture where the tradition is so strongly to not shoot does, this was, and as you say, it remains a very controversial stance to take. But he understood that if you don't control the doe population, you're not going to be able to control the deer population. So it was a very difficult time for him personally, but it was also the first time he had to deal with this quandary. Not just how do you recover rare species, but how do you keep under control common species? And now, these days, with things like Canada geese or other things that we can think of, that is also a big part of what wildlife conservation and management's all about.
Did he get involved in politics and campaigns and sort of national level thinking?
That's a very difficult question to answer in a quick way. He was politically aware and astute and very thoughtful, but also very independent. He never belonged to a political party that we could find overt evidence for. He sort of leaned in what was at that point a sort of Republican progressive mode at that time. He was very strongly for reform, and he did get involved in political campaigns on conservation early in his career. In Wisconsin, he was a well-known figure in state politics and state institutions. But he always stayed very independent, and he said, we can argue over ideologies, and that's good. That's what a democracy is all about. But unless we understand how our ideas affect the land, we're always going to be missing something. And so he always put priority on understanding how our human drama plays out on the land and what it means for the land, and that meant politics too.
What did he mean by that phrase, thinking like a mountain?
He comes up with that phrase. It goes back to that wolf story when he finally sits down in 1944 to write an essay about his early ideas about getting rid of predators so that we can have lots of deer. And he finally sits down, he writes this very contemplative essay, and very kind of inward-looking, and which is unusual for him. And he begins to frame it in this new way, and comes across that phrase, thinking like a mountain. He says, only the mountain has lived long enough to understand what is going on here. Just as a deer population lives in mortal fear of the wolves, a mountain lives in mortal fear of its deer population. And what he meant by that was really all these threads of his own concern. It's the large spatial scale of a mountain. We have to think in large terms to understand what's going on locally.
Space and time?
He's thinking in terms of the time scale. There's a strong thread of evolutionary thinking running through that essay and through much of his later work, where he understands you have to sit back and look at the long-term flux of life on the landscape, including us as a part of it, and understand how that plays out. And it's also, he had a sense, too, of you need to be able to step back and think objectively about this. He understood that none of us are purely objective, even though we scientists like to think of ourselves as objective observers. He understood we're a part of it. But he did say we needed to step back from our immediate self-interest, whether as a hunter or as a protector of wolves or as a botanist or as a business owner, whatever. We needed to step back and think about the interest of the other, the mountain, of ourselves as part of that mountain, and not just in terms of our own particular self-interest.
We're going to look at the legacy of Aldo Leopold when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Like winds and sunsets, wild things were taken for granted until progress began to do away with them. Now we face the question whether a still higher standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free. For us of the minority, the opportunity to see geese is more important than television, and the chance to find a pest flower is a right as inalienable as free speech. That's from the foreword to Aldo Leopold's A Sand County Almanac. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Kurt Meine, who is the author of a biography on Aldo Leopold and also the on-screen guide for a new documentary called Green Fire, Aldo Leopold and the Land Ethic in the 21st Century. Tell us about this film.
We've been at work on it for some time. There's never been a full-length documentary on Aldo Leopold, surprisingly enough, as important a figure as he has been. So this will be the first full documentary of Aldo Leopold. And we're trying to do a couple things in the film. We're trying to get that historical biographical story told well, but we're also trying to show that maybe unique in American conservation history, Leopold is a figure whose relevance not only is sustained, it keeps growing, and it keeps evolving in new and interesting ways. So we're going to try to show in this film, you know, obviously the historical facts and how Leopold developed and how his ideas grew, but also we're trying to show how those ideas continue to affect the way we think about and do conservation, and also how we as Americans relate to our land. So we've been at it now for, going on 3 years. I'm on screen because they felt they needed someone to help connect that history to the contemporary stories. So I'm doing my best to become a adept at a whole new way of communicating.
And what do you see as the most important contribution Leopold made then? If you're sort of, what will be the major message of this film or that you consider to, you know, if you had to say in like one or two sentences what the most important.
We actually asked that question of ourselves. What is the core of this project? And after much mulling and thinking and discussing, we came up with the single word that we felt conveyed, and that word was community. It was a word very important in Leopold's lexicon and had a lot of different dimensions to it because it involved not just the human community that we normally think of, but this expanded sense of the community we belong to. There's this very important phrase in that same foreword to A Sand County Almanac where Leopold says, "We abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. When we see land as a community to which we belong, we may begin to use it with love and respect." So that word was very core to his own thinking, and it was a very important word in his own vocabulary. And the dimensions of that, to me, capture what we're trying to do in the film, showing Leopold's concern for the health of the land as a community, but also the health of our human communities that are embedded in the land. And I think we now understand, and I think more people understand, that you cannot have a healthy human community in a sick landscape or in a sick world. And we're all trying to find our way through this. We're all trying to think, how do we face all these multiple social, economic, environmental problems we face? And Leopold didn't have all the answers, but he had a very important part to add to the conversation, this concept of community that's flexible enough to allow discussion about the relationship between human and natural communities.
What kind of images do you choose for a film like that? I mean, you can't go back too far, can you, and reconstruct the world as Aldo Leopold saw it?
No, you cannot. Nature is always changing, and that was one of the lessons he absorbed in his own life, that part of the way we find our way forward is to learn to change with things, not trying to halt change or control change, but to guide it intelligently and thoughtfully and with a broad sense of values. What's wonderful is we can go to places that Leopold lived and worked, and we can see the changes, positive changes in many cases. Right here in Madison, we can go to the University Arboretum with this whole new dimension of conservation that we now know as ecological restoration, prairie restoration, wetlands, forest restoration. We can go to farm landscapes that were severely eroded, degraded in Leopold's time, and see that they're healthier, if not perfectly healthy. They are certainly healthier. We don't see the kind of soil erosion that Leopold personally witnessed during the Dust Bowl years. We can see wetlands that were dredged and drained and drying out and burning even in Leopold's day, now restored. We can go to urban neighborhoods and see wonderful examples of conservation happening in the urban setting, something we have perhaps neglected in the modern environmental movement, and see that Leopold understood the land ethic as pertaining across the whole landscape. It's not just the wilderness. It's not even just the farms and forest lands and ranch lands that he worked on so much. Our urban and suburban neighborhoods are deserving of love and respect, as he said, too, as well. And that may be, one of the most important frontiers in modern conservation, working in urban settings.
Well, speaking of which, what did he have to say about lakes, since Madison in particular is very lake-bound and lake-dependent?
You know, Leopold, we also always think about the land ethic, because that was a phrase he used to convey these complex ideas to his fellow citizens. But when you go back and carefully look through Leopold's life and work, you see water is woven into it every point along the way. And he himself said, the land isn't just the soil. Soil, water, plants, animals, people. So water was always a part of that. And being in Madison and living in Madison, he was acutely aware of the state of the lakes here locally, but also the value of fresh water. And of course, this is now a global concern and will be from here on out. And that caring for the land and caring for the water are not two different things. They're exactly the same thing, in fact.
One of the programs that Norman and I enjoyed doing was with the children of Aldo Leopold. He seems to have passed along his land ethic and love of nature to them. Can you say something about his family and the way they've carried on the tradition?
Well, some people who are not from Wisconsin, I suppose, think that Leopold's influence comes only through the writing of Sand County Almanac, which is hugely important.
A million seller.
It's changed the way we think about conservation and human relationships to the land. But for us in Wisconsin, we get a different sense of Leopold because of these personal connections. Leopold's family is every bit as important a part of his sustained influence. They all went on to really amazing careers in science and conservation. And they have all lived into their 70s, 80s, and now 90s. And so it's a decades-long influence, hundreds and hundreds of students, thousands of undergraduate students, all across America and beyond. And so Leopold lives on in through his children, through his students, but his kids in particular have the same sense of commitment, dedication, and almost inborn obligation to do their part. They have all played very important roles in their own local places as well as nationally in conservation, have made landmark contributions to many different fields of science.
You mentioned the oil spill in the preface to your revised version of your biography. What do you think Leopold would say about it, other than it's yet another example of the way we mess up our land?
Well, one thing I ought to say is I try to avoid answering any question that starts, what would Aldo think about ... because he was such an original thinker, and he'd often surprise you. And I don't mean to be flip about it, but it's a way of saying that we often ask that question because we're struggling ourselves. We don't know what to think about it. It's very hard to think about. And so rather than asking ourselves, we wonder, what would Aldo think? But plainly, we know how he would have thought about it. He would have understood that this isn't an isolated incident. This is a result of generations of human inability to understand the fullness of our impacts on the landscape, of our addiction to fossil fuels in a modern economy, of our inability to, so far anyway, get past it, and that this ought to be a sign to wake up, to go to work, to forge a new economy, a new way of understanding these relationships. In this case, it's going to be a dramatic, I feel very strongly that this is going to be impacting us for generations to come. Not just the physical environmental impacts, but because it puts squarely in front of us the question of the relationship between our human economy and the natural world on which the economy depends. Leopold had a phrase once. He said, "We fancy that industry supports us, forgetting what supports industry." This oil spill and other events that we can think of force us to think about our economy in that way, to understand that it all relies on the health of the natural communities, landscapes, and systems that we depend on.
What would he have taken greatest satisfaction in, do you think?
Well, you know, in recent lectures and talks, I've been doing a couple slides I use back-to-back now. First one was the litany of woe, all those big, awful, global, environmental, destructive forces we worry about, population and water and climate change and food. And it's easy to put a list like that together. But after a few times of doing that, I said, I need another slide. It's going to be called the Litany of Hope, the positive forces out there that are afoot now that we can look to, if not with hope, at least with an understanding you have to make these changes. If I had to choose one right now, I would say Leopold would probably take great satisfaction in those local efforts of communities who come to terms with their own local concerns and begin to do work on them, and to work across political boundaries and even political ideologies at a time when we badly need to find good examples of that, to say we're going to work together. We're going to work together to sustain our landscape, to sustain our communities, to improve our local community life, even as we work to improve the landscape and to make it healthier, to bring back species, to control the invasives, to work toward greener energy sources and all the other things. But it doesn't mean anything unless it happens in a way that's local, that you can feel, you can have, as Leopold said, had faith in. And so I think he would take probably his greatest satisfaction from seeing that the land ethic is alive and well in a million communities here in the state of Wisconsin, around the country, and even around the world.
Kurt Meine, thanks for spending this hour with us.
And thank you so much.
Hour with Aldo Leopold. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, we'll search for Robin Hood, and we'll do it in an unlikely way, our guide being early musician Tina Chancey. It's the Search for Robin Hood next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.